whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
From Samuel Huntington's highly controversial Who Are We to the urgent appeal of Naomi Wolf's The End of America, Americans are increasingly reflecting on questions of democracy, multiculturalism, and national identity. Yet such debates take place largely at the levels of elites, leaving out ordinary American citizens who have much to offer about the lived reality behind the phrase, I am an American. Cynthia Weber with us. She is the author of I Am an American, Filming of Fear of Indifference, and it's a memoir. Cynthia, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What a fascinating topic, I think, with what we really have at this stage of the game, post 9/11, and I've been on this planet for a lot of years now, and today, more than any other time in our history, the definition of what is an American cannot be, it just can't be spelled out in such a way that everybody has an understanding. So let's start from scratch, Cynthia, and let's say, where was it for you that you saw this problem? What did you do? What caused you to put it to pen?
Well, let's start with what it actually is supposed to mean to be an American, because that's sure. The kind of problem that I think about a lot as a U.S. citizen who's lived out of the United States for at least 10 years. And, you know, what I was taught in school, that what it means to be an American, a U.S. American, is that everybody enjoys the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that we all enjoy freedom and equality under the law, and that we all get to live our lives in the context of the American melting pot, right, where what that means is that our individual differences of race or religion or national origin melt away when we mix in with other U.S. citizens, because we're all U.S. citizens. And so, you know, those are the kinds of ideals that we hold on to. And what sort of inspired me to think about those more deeply was not just only living abroad, but when I came back to the United States shortly after September 11, I was just outside of New York. And I was at a funeral for a family member, and I was in her home. The television was on, and I was watching this public service announcement that came on the television. It was the very famous "I Am an American" public service announcement. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but what it is U.S. citizens of various ages, races, and religions just sort of looking directly into the camera and saying, "I am an American." And what this public service announcement was doing was celebrating this very melting pot ideal that I was talking about, and celebrating how the United States is a tolerant nation. And it even ends with the U.S. motto, E Pluribus Unum, or, you know, out of one, many, by which the makers of the ad said that what they meant was, you know, out of many different kinds of U.S. Americans, we are just one unified nation. And, you know, certainly because I was at a funeral and because this was a very moving time for the country just after 9/11, I was very moved by this advertisement. I thought it was very well done. But on the other hand, I was quite worried about it because, on the one hand, I sort of thought it protested a little bit too much, that what it was doing was reminding U.S. citizens of who we are as U.S. Americans, but reminding U.S. citizens of this to be tolerant because there was a concern that there would be a backlash against different U.S. Americans in the wake of September 11. Michael, the subtitle of the book is Filming the Fear of Difference, not Filming the Fear of Indifference. And it was that fear of difference, the press release is wrong, so it's not your mistake, but it was that fear of difference that had me wondering, you know, who are going to be these U.S. citizens who may find themselves to be deemed to be too different, so that they don't actually melt into this one unified nation. So that's what inspired me to go around and talk to U.S. citizens about their experiences.
Let me come at this from a different perspective. Cynthia, I was born in the early 40s, and so I was brought up in the 50s. John Wayne is still my hero. Okay. But that said, I'm a former Marine. I went through boot camp in 1960. I'll give you what my personal definition of an American is, because I'm an American. I love my country. I say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I will sing the national anthem. I happen to be Jewish, but I celebrate Christmas with all the friends that I've had all of my life. We've had trees. We've done everything that there is possible to do. What I am starting to see in within the multiculturalism, if I can get the word out, what I'm starting to see is people coming from other countries who are running from those countries because they're being killed, they're being tortured, they're being taken advantage of, and they run here for everything that you just said that we can have, and then they try to make this what they ran away from. And I really believe when it comes down to it, I've watched ads on television. If you're a particular ethnicity or gender or something, if you open a mouth and you say something, they're going to come down on you. If you're a certain ethnicity, a gender or something, you can say anything you want to say, because if you say anything against it, you're a racist, you're this and you're that, you're whatever. I think that in and of itself has stopped that melting pot that you're talking about. It was a melting pot at one time. When somebody came here, they became an American. And, of course, you can have your culture and all of your history at home. There's one language here. There is one set of values and rules. And if you're going to come in here, follow it, because you can do anything that you want to do here. You can make any kind of money you want to make here. You can be in any kind of a relationship that you want to be in here. But I think the problem was when we lost the definition and we were so worried about people being intolerant that we killed ourselves with it.
Well, I mean, you make a lot of points there, and I think there are a lot of points to make in response. I mean, this idea that people came to the United States or came to America and the Americas and then, you know, and brought with them what they left behind, I mean, that's actually the tradition of the United States, certainly, and it's a tradition of immigration, that when you move from one place, you might be trying to escape persecution, but you're doing that so you can, you know, live your life as you want to live it. I mean, you know, you think about the pilgrims and their search for religious freedom and why they came to you know, what were then the colonial country, the colonial, you know, colonies of the Americas. So, you know, there are those sorts of things that kind of go on. And that's got a historical tradition. This idea that maybe there are certain, you didn't name what kinds of, you know, gender or race or sexual preference one can be and get away with anything these days. But it sounds like what you're talking about, Michael, is a sense of political correctness, that people are afraid to speak against people of, you know, who were otherwise seen to be different. But actually, the way that a lot of the structures work in the United States, unfortunately, still is still to marginalize a lot of people in really significant ways. I mean, let me give you an example of you're a Marine. Well, let me give you an example of somebody I interviewed in the book. His name is James Yee. He was a West Point graduate. He's of Chinese descent, and he was a chaplain in the U.S. Army. He served at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, as the Muslim chaplain. He's a Muslim. He was a Muslim chaplain, and his way of practicing Americanness, maybe it wasn't exactly like John Wayne to kind of go off and conquer new territories, but it was to kind of uphold some of these, you know, these traditional values that people associate with the United States, like the right to religious accommodation, the freedom of, you know, to worship as they see fit. And also for James, and I'm sure you understand this as well with your military background, the humane treatment of prisoners. These things were important to him. And he was serving honorably in his job. He was getting, you know, accommodations for good service. And one day he was going home on home leave. He thought everything was normal. But when he stepped back on U.S. territory from Cuba, which is where Guantanamo Bay is, he was arrested. He was charged with aiding and abetting the enemy. Somebody even referred to him as a, quote, Chinese Taliban, unquote. His family didn't know where he was. He just disappeared. He was put in solitary confinement for 76 days. He was threatened by the military prosecutors with the death penalty for things that, you know, he just simply had no idea what was going on. And why he had no idea what was going on is because there was no case to answer. The charges were eventually dropped, and James' record was cleared. And while his military career, of course, was in ruins because of this, he did receive an honorable discharge. But you know, what we have here is a situation where, what, you know, the way James tells his story, that all he can think of, the reason why he was victimized in this way was not because he wasn't being a good patriotic American, but was because he appeared to the people on base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, as having too much in common with the Muslim prisoners, and it was his job to actually associate with them, and also because he was of you know ethnic Chinese origin. So I sure. think it's when we go back, and you also made the point that, well, we've lost this definition of what it means to be an American. I mean, I just don't think that's I don't think there ever is a kind of fixed definition of Americanness. I think it's something that we invent all the time. And one of the things that's very important, as you know, one of the reasons why it was important for me to make these films and write this book, is because we need to visit all of the complicated ways that we invest that notion of Americanness with meaning, so that we can be responsible for it, and we can think about actually what we want it to mean, not just in kind of abstract terms, like I was speaking about earlier, you know, the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but how we actually make freedom and equality under the law something that all U.S. citizens actually have a right to in practice.
Now, okay, let me qualify it by this. And one of the most important things that we can talk about here is this, and we'll talk about definition. My personal family, my own personal family, in my family, there's Filipino, there's African American, there's Alaska Native, there is Mexican. They're all Americans. I don't see any difference in color, style, creed, or anything else. And if you want to talk about political correctness, if there is a category of person that has been put up against the wall, I think it's been the Caucasian white male. Because if you take a look at it, all we have to do is open our mouth, and we're in trouble, and we're racist, and we kill babies, and, I mean, the list goes on and on. So when there's got to be equality, it's got to be across the board. It can't just be towards a particular race, an ethnicity, or a gender. And I have seen picture after picture. I've seen what's going on with La Raza and some of these places in Los Angeles and in Southern California, where I've seen the pictures where they don't show them on television, where the middle finger is stuck up in the air and this and that of you, America, and it belongs to us and whatever. You see, that is, there's a tremendous amount of that underlying a lot of these politically correct agendas that are going on. So we have to say, what is it? Go to Texas. Texas right now denies that there was ever an Alamo. If you go back and you check, Santa Anna's army, those guys were nasty. I mean, they were bad. But we don't look at it that way today. You know, we're always looking for the poor victim that's being picked on. That we have to get away from, because that in and of itself dilutes us. It gives us that lack of strength. You want to kill this, not you personally, but you want to kill this country, you do it by divisions. And you look at what's happening in the last couple, 3 years. The genders are divided. The sexual orientation is divided. Everybody's after somebody else. You got kids running around having fun and destroying things. You know, that's what's going on now. That's not America. But that's what.
Well, but the problem is that, I mean, that's a very interesting statement that you end on, right? That's not America, but it's part of the United States of America, and it's precisely. I mean, I'm not sure we're on a different page here in the sense of, you know, the question is, well, you know, what should it mean to be an American? We have these ideal principles that we hold ourselves to, and we should be accountable to them. And I'm not, I would still make the argument that well, you know, what you want to call political correctness is, I still think that's a response to lots of people who have traditionally had histories of not enjoying the same rights in the United States as they should, as other citizens should. But the larger point here is about the question of tolerance, right? I mean, if we're a tolerant nation, if we understand ourselves to be a tolerant nation and a tolerant people, we have to be very clear about how tolerance actually very easily slips into being intolerance. Now, you and I may disagree about how that happens and who's being intolerant of whom, but we might agree that that's something that happens. I mean, when I think of the relationship between tolerance and intolerance, I think of it almost like the relationship between laughing and crying. You know, they're so very close to one another that they can change very quickly. And the reason that tolerance can become intolerance is because if you say, you know, to somebody, you know, if I say to you, I tolerate you, Okay. What I've done is I've put myself in a position of being able to judge whether or not you are allowed to carry on, and you know, you deserve the right to carry on as you do. I've put myself in a superior position. And what that means also is that I reserve the right to stop tolerating you at any time. And that's a really that's not necessarily the way we want to practice tolerance in the United States. Whether it's historically or whether we look to the future, you know, after September 11 or now after the 10th anniversary of September 11. Because the problem is that, you know, if I reserve the right to stop tolerating you at any time, that what happens is that it doesn't matter who you are, whatever category, whether you happen to be, you know, a Muslim of Chinese descent or whether you happen to be, you know, a white Anglo-Saxon Christian, depending on how fear and terrorism fear and patriotism get aligned, what you could find is that you're on the wrong side of that, you know, notion of being tolerated or not tolerated at any time. I mean, it could happen to any of us. And let me give you another example of somebody who, you know, I interviewed who actually found himself. This is a white, Anglo, middle-class academic, an artist, not a Muslim. His name is Steve Kurtz, and what he does is he does art practice that tries to get people to think about difficult questions of biotechnology. Things like, you know, genetically modified foods or the uses of human DNA. He goes to sleep one night with his wife, Hope. He wakes up the next morning and Hope is dead. He calls 911. The police come and they find, you know, that Hope has died, but they also find that Steve has a biology lab in his house. Now, he explains that, you know, this is part of his art practice and that he only uses benign bacteria in his art practice. And to prove this, he even dips his finger into a petri dish and puts it in his mouth and licks it to show that, you know, everything is harmless. But even so, and even this white, Anglo-Saxon, you know, middle-class male, he's arrested on suspicion of murdering his wife. And then this is the one I don't get at all. He's also arrested on suspicion of bioterrorism. Now, this happens even though the coroner said that his wife, Hope, died of natural causes, even though the FBI's autopsy confirmed this, and even though the FBI's test confirmed that all the substances in his house were benign.
Okay,
so,
wait a minute. Let me hold you up for a minute because I think you're making a very important point, but I want to counter it with something. We're starting to run out of time, but I want to make sure we counter this, all right? Absolutely. But, you know, just recently, there was a kid that it was in, I think it was in Florida. It was all over the news this morning. They found explosives all over his room. They found detonators, and he had plans to make to go in and kill about 33 to 40 people in his own particular high school. When we have a world like that, you bet when you find that kind of chemistry, you check it out before anything can happen. Because why would
you check it out? And if it's dangerous, you arrest
suspicion
the person. That's absolutely true. But if it's not dangerous, you know, and when your own tests confirm that it's not dangerous, you don't actually bring him up on Mickey Mouse charges that last for 4 years. I mean, the charges of bioterrorism and murdering his wife had to be dropped quite early, but then they brought charges of wire fraud and mail fraud against him because they were just looking for something to put him away with because they didn't understand his kind of art practice. That doesn't bring security to the United States. That means we're changing we're using our resources in ways that actually aren't helpful.
Tell the administration.
So, I'm not making an argument about, you know, anything goes and everyone is wonderful. I'm saying that, you know, that the way that intolerance has been practiced and the way that people have found themselves on the wrong side of the with us or against us war on terror has been about how we've interpreted patriotism through fear. And it's those particular cases, not, you know, the whole wide range of whether we've got school shooters or school bombers, but those particular cases about how U.S. citizens' access to their rights have become conditional because of the way that patriotism and fear have been aligned. And I think that, you know, the bumper sticker slogan of September 11, the 10th anniversary, is "We will never forget." And I don't think we should. You know, I think we should think about what happened on that day and certainly mourn the loss of life that occurred on that day. We also have to remember the stuff that we don't really want to remember, and maybe stuff we didn't even realize happened. Maybe, you know, we don't remember it because we never knew it in the first place. Things like the way that tolerance becomes intolerance, how patriotism and fear, you know, work together, and how actually any one of us could find ourselves in these situations of intolerance if we're not careful. Or even if we are careful. I mean, I don't think Steve Kirsch did anything that wasn't careful, and he ended up in this position.
Now,
so,
by the way,
you know,
we're going to have...
I think that these are important lessons for us to take away when we think about who we are as U.S. citizens and who we want to become as a nation and a people in the future.
All right, let me close it off with this. I think tolerance should be thrown out the window, and I think the word should be replaced with respect. There is power in respect. Tolerance is garbage because people misuse it, abuse it, and cause a lot of problems with it. So I think the word respect would trump anything that tolerance can do. And with
we definitely need to move beyond tolerance. And if by respect what you're talking about is a situation in which equality and freedom is not based on some kind of hierarchical judgment about whether you deserve it or not, but it's something that we just, you know, initially, you know, you give to people only, you know, and only take it away when there's actual evidence that you know, there's some security problem here or some risk, and we have to be very careful about how those things get defined, then sure, I agree with that.
Yeah, by the way, let me give you, we have to go, but let me give you my last definition of an American. I am an American, and I love my country, and I don't even know you, but I love you, okay? Yeah, I would respect you. If we totally disagreed, I'd open a door for you. If you were in trouble, I would be right there to help. And that, I think, is what an American is. And I don't care if you were green, I'd say the same thing to you.
Well, the idea is that difference shouldn't be something that, you know, interferes with how people treat one another humanely. And that, whether that's as U.S. citizens or as citizens, you know, how the United States treats people outside of the United States. But, you know, in the context of the U.S., that's, you know,
I hear you. Hey, Cynthia, we got to go. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I've got a Facebook page called I Am an American. If you just Google I Am an American at Facebook, it's there. I've got another website that I'm going to launch in September called it's www.IamAnAmericanProject.com, and that will have all of the films on it and some of the images and text from the book. And the book is I Am an American, Filming the Fear of Difference, which can be found in the United States at the University of Chicago Press, or for people in Britain from Intellect Books. And all of the films are going to end up as part of they've been invited to be part of the permanent collection of the September 11 Memorial Museum that's being built at Ground Zero. So they'll be available online as soon as they can get them cataloged, and they'll be available on site next year when the museum opens.
Dynamite. Cynthia Weber, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Monica Dukia with us. She is the author of Out of the Mirror Clay, How to Overcome a Painful Past and Live Victoriously. She's an accomplished scientist with degrees in chemistry and genetic engineering, has worked with global pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical sector. She's also a Christian theologian and a conference speaker who holds honors, bachelor of theology degree. She's a columnist and a Christian minister who is a sought after global speaker and the author of two books. One is the Out of the Mary Clay and the Return of the King. And let us say, Monita, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. How are you this afternoon?
Oh, I'm good. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did. You got it right on spot on.
Okay. We got a good start. Let me ask you this. When we really talk about taking a look at the past and becoming all we can be, how does a person transition to that? And Monita, I'm quite confident that you've met so many people that they're covered up, they're hiding, they're running around in fear, afraid to be who they are. How do you get them to take that first step to realize the potential that really lies within all of us?
Well, the thing is, Michael, we are a product of our experiences. We can't really dismiss them or forget it. We've got to deal with it. And the only way to transition from your past into your future is to look at it in a sort of a cathartic way. What happened? Why did it happen? What could I do with this? Is this going to paralyze me for the rest of my life? Is it going to dictate who I am, what I'm going to be? Or am I going to look at it and say, look, some of this I've got to deal with. I had nothing to do with it. It just happened. The other part of it is I'm going to take this and I'm going to turn this into something positive and press on. So it's entirely up to the person what you're going to do. And a lot of people, unfortunately, it's a lot more easy to sort of forget it, hide it, insulate yourself in lies about it, just ignore the problem, sweep it under the carpet, it's going to go away. Well, it does not, because a lot of times what happens to you, it's in your psyche, it's not going anywhere. It just gets worse and worse.
No,
and
Monita,
you find yourself
when we okay,
years later, it is and you're psychic. Looking at this problem, that's just snowballing.
Now, you said it. It's in your psychic. And I think one of the major problems is, how do I deal with a problem that I don't know that I have? Most of us work on a problem that we don't have as opposed to the one we do have, and we end up never getting anywhere. So having it in your psychic, and obviously everything we've ever done, seen, felt, experienced is held somewhere in that brain in one particular part of the mind, wherever it may be. So it's held there. You see something in life, you recognize an experience that was like something that happened to you. It doesn't have to be specific, but it could be close enough. And then we find ourselves reacting to that experience. We're reacting to somebody in front of us that has nothing to do with what went on 20, 30, 40 years ago. So it's the recognition of the problem, and it's getting to the problem, I think, is the real problem, quote unquote.
Yeah, it's sort of the one thing you go ask yourself is, why am I behaving like this? For instance, you've got a trigger, and you might not know it's something in your past that happened to you when you were a child, and it's this trigger, and you've just gone off the deep end, and you go mental on it without even realizing why you're behaving like this. And I think it's important to ask yourself, why am I doing this? Is it normal? How does it impact the other person or people around? Why do I react like this? How does it impact me? Is it positive? Is it negative? You know, a lot of times we say things, and I'm guilty of this sometimes. I get angry, and I might say something, and I don't think about it. And I don't realize it's going to hurt somebody. And then after that, I look at it, and I thought, well, that wasn't very good. But a lot of people, they're so wrapped up in what has happened and in their own little world, because really they've got this mask of pain and despair, and they're really trying to survive. They're in survival mode. Yes, you can exist in survival mode, but really I think it's living in defeat. It's not in victory, is it? Because you're only in survival mode. There's so many other things you can experience. There's a whole world out there. There's a whole life out there just waiting for you. and yet you're caught up in the past, or you're stuck in one phase, and you're not getting out.
No, survival mode.
That's what I do. I try to get people to sort of step out of their shell.
Okay, but survival mode is a chemical reaction.
Deal with the problems. Deal with it spot on. Otherwise, it's not going to go away.
But let me go back to where I was with that. Survival mode is a chemical reaction. And I think that in and of itself, when we begin to understand the dynamic of our body and our mind and our brain and the emotions and all those chemicals that cause us to do and be who we are and the end result of all of our actions. Because if you can make that transition, if that one thought, that one look somebody's giving you doesn't have the same meaning it had 30 years ago, the chemistry changes. And instead of adrenaline, you're pumping dopamine, quote unquote. And I think that in and of itself, is a realization that you don't have to be and feel what you felt in your life. Most people go through life thinking that they have to do it. Now, let me take this on a personal level with you. What was this that brought this about with you, for you? What was it that caused you to look at this issue, study it, put it to pen, and then take the step to help people?
Well, honestly, I mean, I'm a scientist, and it's sort of funny because my friends always laugh. I'm a scientist, and I'm a Christian minister as well. And, you know, I was married, I had a thriving ministry, and everything went well. And what happened, I was devastated with a spouse who cheated, stole everything, and I lost everything. My whole world came crumbling down. Everything you could think about happened that should not happen. And at the end, I was standing there left with nothing. So I had two ways I could go. One, go spiraling down. I had every reason to go that way because it was just ridiculous. It was heinous. No one should go through that. And then there was this other path whereby I could say to myself, well, you know what? I'm going to get through this. I have got to deal with this spot on, head on. So I had to make that choice. And it was not an easy choice, but for me, it was the only choice. I didn't want to go down that other path, and it was perfectly fine. It's easy. It made sense. But in life, it's a fork in the road. What are you going to do? Everybody's going to come to a fork in the road, and you're going to have to choose one. So for me, personally, going through the path that I wanted to go through and coming out victoriously, that's why I wrote Out of the Miry Clay. I'm a scientist. I mean, I'm used to boardrooms and laboratories and FDA conferences and all that. I'm a scientist, but what happened to me changed me forever. And I penned Out of the Miry Clay because I wanted to reach out to those people that I know that are hurting and they're hiding and are just wearing masks and are pretending everything is great. But inside, they're numb, and it's not a way for anybody to live.
No question about it. And that abuse comes in many, many different sizes and shapes and form. You can be beaten. You can be emotionally beaten. You can have everything, as you said, stolen from you. And that in and of itself is an abuse. But I think the real question is this. You know, we have in this country that women who are abused, that for the most part, there are groups or organizations, there's some kind of collaboration. There's always that support system that if you know where to go to, that they're there to help, that truly have an understanding that most people won't. Because you have to have been there, done that, before you can actually sit down with somebody to discuss it with them. I think the real problem, not necessarily in this country, but in other countries, in cultures who come to this country who don't consider women as equal citizens, you know, they're the products, they're property. Then you've got the problem, because then I think those are the women that really need to be reached. And it's very hard because they have those challenges and all that pain around them that every time they go to step up to the plate, they get knocked down. How do you handle that? And that is not an easy question.
Well, first of all, let me preface that by saying I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I mean, being a minister and being in industry for so long, even in the workplace, I've come across so many people in the pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical sector who are VPs and CEOs and directors and all that, who are being abused, but they choose not to talk about it because they're embarrassed. And you can have as many organizations as you want, but no one wants to step out and say, hey, I'm a victim, because they're embarrassed. These are not people who are, you know, working at Walmart or something. These are people with advanced degrees. These are people who lead corporations, and they're abused, but they hide it. I know. I was one of those people. I could tell you. And then we've got the other side of the coin that has got a cultural thing to it. And yes, we work in different cultures. I do a lot of work in Asia, and I do a lot of work in South America. And when I go there, it just breaks your heart. I mean, people are so battered and traumatized, they've got no clue of how to be human anymore. And that always catches me off guard. No matter how many times I go there and I talk to them, it just numbs me for a point where I don't know what to do sometimes. Because you can talk and you can talk, but unless the person understand that the behavior being heaped on them is abuse, they're not going to deal with it.
It's going beyond.
In different cultures, for instance, in Asian cultures or South American cultures, a lot of times they don't even know that they're being abused. Whereas I find in Western civilizations, for instance, in the UK, when I go there and I minister, it's more of, yes, I do know I'm being abused, but I'm not going to talk about it because it's my dirty little secret and I don't want anyone to know about it. So it's trying to draw people out of their shell, whether it's Western or Eastern or wherever it is. And that's the most difficult part, is getting someone to admit or to even see it for what it is.
Admitting it, and it's going to be a very interesting point, because if you admit it, the major problem is this. If you admit it, then all of a sudden that means that the life that you know and the people that you're around, you may lose. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because if you're being abused, get out of there. But that's easier said than done. That's
exactly.
A very interesting thing when you're dealing with people.
It is. It is. It's very difficult. And, you know, like I told you, when I talk about the fork in the road, it was so easy for me to say, you know what? I'm going to deal with this divorce and deal with all of what has happened to me and what I'm going through and get back to my little fancy little senior director and VP position and carry on with it. But as a minister, I knew I had to do something, because this is not the way. We could all ignore the problem, but it's not going to go away. And a lot of people are just living in a substandard existence, and I don't think it's right.
No question about it.
Go ahead.
No, I just said no question about it. It's not right. And at the same time, you have to, and you said you have to be able to, first, you have to recognize it. I don't even think you have to understand it. It's recognize it. You understand that. That's in that intellectual part of your brain. You recognize it. It goes to your emotional part of your brain. That's going to be the stimulant to create some kind of action. But the point
if
of condemnation.
You've got to recognize it. You've got to say, look, I don't want to live like this anymore. And that's what I do in my conferences when I talk to people and I tell them it's the most precious thing in your life. It's not money and all those things, the pretty things you can buy. It is time. And once you lose time, you can't gain that time anymore. It's gone. So make sure you live your life to the fullest.
No, and by the way, no question whatsoever. We are starting to run out of time. Monita, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. My website is www.outofthemyrieclay.net.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. And I think that you're right there and you're spot on for this time in our world and our history, because there's a lot of women out there that, especially now, that they have so much to offer, but they're blindsided and they're held back. And maybe it's time that they knew that it was okay.
I'll leave with one quote. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "No one can make you feel inferior without your permission."
Absolutely.
So
and
stop
with that,
giving
would,
people the permission to make you feel inferior and live victoriously.
And thank you for that. And with that, thank you so much for being with us, and good night.
Good night.
All these arms to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. That's all. Second,
spring, a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ted McLyman with us, CEO of Apex Behavioral Group. He's a fully licensed financial advisor and he's an author. And prior to forming the company, he was a district manager with two major financial planning firms. He's a retired Lieutenant Colonel USMC, where he served in various commands and staff positions to include economics instructor, U.S. Naval Academy, aide to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy of the Financial Management, and served a tour in Southwest Asia during the Operation Desert Storm. And he's also an accomplished public speaker and a trainer. And let's say, Ted, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Oh, thank you. Can we start with this? Semper Fi.
Say again, please.
I said we can start with Semper Fi.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, by the way, me too. Okay.
Yeah, really? Good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's the Green Gun Club. It got us where we are today. That's all I can say.
I'll tell you that one. But I was in way back when, and as a matter of fact, I went through boot camp at MCRD in 1960. So it was a couple of years
ago. You're ahead of me by a couple of years.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. The book, Money Makes Me Crazy, Prescriptions for Money Sanity. In today's world, do we actually have any kind of a definition for money? Because I think really when you're dealing with financial literacy, for the most part, most people don't get it. And you have a definition of money when you're 15, 16 years old. You get another definition when you're 20 based on your life, something else at 35, 40, and then it moves on from there. But the key here basically is this. Most people are using their 15-year-old definition when they're in their 20s and their mid-20s, and that is enough to make them crazy. So do we first have to...
Oh, you got it.
Yeah.
You bring up a really good point. I think money is kind of a euphemism right now for about anything you want to call it, a good time, life, happiness, whatever. But what we're finding in our research, and we discuss in the book, is number one, money is biological. Our brains are really not wired to work well with money. Our brains biologically are about 100,000 years old, and the behavior that kept us alive in the forest is killing us at the mall. Number two, it's our belief system. Most of us learn about money when we're growing up, and by the time we're about 12 years old, we have a pretty good idea of what money is, good, bad, or indifferent. But it really does make a foundational set for what we do in the rest of our lives. Culture is another thing that dictates how we look at money. I mean, all you've got to do is walk around, head to the mall. We're a consumption culture, and that is a significant impact. But I think most importantly, the rules of money have changed. And what we learned about money as a kid or what you learned in high school probably isn't appropriate today in today's economy.
No, absolutely. I know somebody now, which is very interesting. She has a very limited income, and this has been this way most of her life. She has a very limited income, and the minute that she gets money monthly, the first thing she goes out and does is she spends it. Now, it's all gone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then she can worry about not having any money.
Well, and again, that's a behavioral thing.
Yes.
I think the common wisdom that we have in our society, that money is there to spend, and we think that spending is going to make us happy. And in reality, from a biological perspective and a cultural perspective, it really doesn't. It's the quest that makes us happy. It's the drive, the journey. Having stuff and money itself really does not satisfy that need for happiness. And unfortunately, people are deluded that if they just go after stuff, and I've got more stuff than you have, and my stuff is better than your stuff, for some reason it's going to give me some kind of inner peace, we're finding that's not the case at all. Money is nothing more than a tool. It's the journey and where you are. So really what we're talking about is we want you to have peace of mind in your chosen lifestyle.
Now, by the way, I think you've really hit something spot on, because I haven't heard anybody say this before. Money, you know, the behavior system, behavior. You know, realistically, when you think about this, you get a dollar in your hand or whatever denomination, there's going to be a chemical reaction hit that brain. It's either going to be fight or flight. You're either going to defend or you're going to be happy about it. You're going to spend it or you're going to save it. You're going to do something. It's behavior. It is a learned response and it's automatic. And to change it, you've got to go through an entire revamp of your own system. And once you redefine what it is, then you look at it differently. And when you look at it differently, your body will help you accordingly, appropriately.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Let me give you an example. Have you ever been had to run to the store, pick up milk and bread, and you walk out and you look down in your cart, you've got $80 worth of stuff, and you forgot the milk and bread?
Yeah.
I mean, we do that kind of stuff all the time. And again, we have a short thinking mind. Our brain is for the now. It is not really good at long-term planning. It's not really good at money. It's not good with numbers. It likes stories. It likes now. It basically, our brain is designed to do two things very, very well: keep us alive and pass on the genes. Everything else is secondary.
Now, by the way, see, you've hit it, and that's the most important thing. When you're dealing with money, money is a response. And if people get that they've got a particular money response, and the end result of what they do is going to cause whatever happens in their life, all of a sudden they've got a handle on it. It's not telling somebody, don't use your credit card, put this much money away, don't shop over there. That's not what it is at all. It starts internally. And if you can get it targeted internally, then externally, life is a lot better.
Oh, I agree 100%. And this is what makes it so confusing, because the financial services industry, of which I'm a part, makes you think that it's all about product and service, features and benefits. If you have the right stuff, if you buy it from the right person, it's going to make you happy, it's going to be success, et cetera, et cetera. It's not. All that is a vehicle. What you have to do, really, and I talk about this at length in the book, Money Makes Me Crazy, it's about values. What are your codifying values that define who you are, and if they're not accomplished, they're going to cause you some kind of angst in your life? Then we also talk about, we call it money temperament. We think everybody has a unique money temperament, and that is how you think and feel about money. And all you've got to do is sit and talk to a couple and ask them about truly what's important about money to them. And they look at each other, and often for the first time in their lives, they go, my gosh, I've never thought about that, and I never realized that, Ted, you really, at the end of your life, you wanted to have your ashes spread at the 50-yard line at Yankee Stadium or something like that. Then the other piece, and you got into it a little bit, was money knowledge. Money knowledge is really broader than just knowing about money stuff. It's how you process information. And what we do in our practice, and what we try to convey in the book, for you to really have control of your finances and your money and move to what's important to you in life, the first thing you have to do is know yourself. Who are you? What are your values? How do you think and feel about money? But also, how do you process information? Are you a visual learner? Are you an auditory learner? Are you a tactile learner? I think one of the most frustrating things I see in our industry is people come in and see me, and because we're financial advisors, we tend to be a little analytical. We like the numbers. We actually enjoy doing this stuff. Well, most of the people that come to see us don't, but then we try to make them just like us. What should happen is I should respect you for who you are, how you think and feel about money, and design a strategy based around that. The tools are almost secondary. They've become a commodity. And unfortunately, I don't think the industry is conveying that, or most of the general public don't realize the magic is not in the stuff. The magic is you.
No question about it. As a matter of fact, I want to go back to what you were talking about when you said you would sit down with a couple and basically they would be shocked because they didn't think of money that way. Could you imagine how many marriages would be saved in the first, second, or third year if the couple actually sat down before they got married and one was saying to the other, what do you think about money? What's money? How should money be spent? And then vice versa. Now you know what you're dealing with, and you can work with it or not work with it. You can make a choice. But what happens for the most part, they get married 3 or 4 years down the 3, 4, 5 years down the road. They're battling over what? Money. Money has got to be one of the major causes of divorces today. One doesn't like the other way, the way the other one spends it, and so on and so on. Extremely important.
Oh, I agree with you. It's also a major problem with work, productivity, retention, substance abuse, domestic violence. It goes on and on and on because in our society, one, we really don't talk about money. Two, we don't really educate people for what money is and what it can do. And finally, I do believe the rules have changed. I mean, think about it for a second. When you and I were growing up, we were told to get a great, you know, work hard, get a good education, get a great job, work, do a good job for 20, 30 years, get that pension, retire in your house, surrounded by your kids, pass away at age 72, life is great. Well, that rule, you know, how's that working out today? It's just not there anymore. So one of the things that I try to convey to my clients is today everybody is self-employed. You have to look at yourself as the CEO of your own company. You've got to understand what you're good at, what you're passionate with. You've got to understand what your value set are, how you react with money, how you work with people, and then move forward accordingly. But because we're human, we have this short-term focus. Most Americans, a good planning day is, what am I going to do this weekend, not what am I going to do in 50 years. So we know that we're not hardwired to do that. So we think very strongly that you've got to sit down and have a coach. You should have somebody you can trust that you can work with, but first and foremost, what's important about money to you? What are the things that drive you crazy about money? And we have a lot of exercises in the book that get into that, that help you walk through this process to make you really discover who you are, how money works for you, and then hopefully help you discover how to work with maybe a professional if you think that's warranted.
Yeah, Ted, when it comes down to it, and in the first interview for tonight, I would bring the same thing up again. But it obviously towards a different subject matter, but it's true. It runs universal. You, if you work on a problem you don't have, you're never going to fix it. You've got to find out what the real problem is, and then you can work on it. Most people are in trouble because they're working on the wrong problem. You ask the you ask the wrong questions, you get the right answers for the wrong questions. You begin to ask the right questions.
Exactly.
You're focused.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. And again, I think, as our culture, we've got this misconception of money. We don't even know how to ask the question. And probably the easiest way to ask the question right now for your listeners, just think for a minute what is really important about you to money. What does money do for you? Why do you need it? Why is it important? Then look at your calendar and look at your checkbook. If you say what's really important is opening a mission in China, but you look at your checkbook and your calendar and it says eating out, buying cars, buying clothing, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to judge and say one's better than the other, but you're not aligned very well. And that's going to cause problems.
And we're starting to run out of time, Ted, but I think the real indicator when you have whatever enough means, when you have enough money and you've satisfied some of those goals, is when you go to sleep at night and you go to sleep. And when you wake up in the morning, you're smiling, you look at the mirror, and you're just busy going about your business. And I think that in and of itself is the real magic when you've got it put together the right way. Let me ask you this.
I agree with you 100%. We call that peace of mind in your chosen lifestyle. And if you've got peace of mind, you've got it all together.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, sir. It's myapex.com. We've got a lot of information on the book, a lot of information on some of the things we're doing. It's very exciting. We're finding we're actually one of the first firms in the country to really get into the behavioral piece.
And by the way, when we're speaking about money, I just take you right back for a minute and just give you a little bit of a smile. When I was when I went through boot camp, we were getting $179 a month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know the days.
Okay.
Had more money in your pocket then than a lot of people do today.
Absolutely. Okay. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you so much, and Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. Good night.
That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold to you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms because I want.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back. Susan Marshall. She is the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And we're going to, let me see, what's tonight's topic? Wait, I got to wipe the desk off. Hold it. I got to clean this up before she gets on. Oh, wait a minute. I got this book over here I have to move. And where'd the bio go? Oh, Susan. Hi, how are you?
Good evening, Michael Ray. How are you?
What was the topic tonight? Focus?
What are we talking about? Yeah, focus, maybe? Priorities? Focus. Learning to say no?
Uh-uh.
In order to say yes?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, so let's start with this notion of priorities, because we live at a time when we are told that, you know what, you can have it all. And so we get very excited when we think about, oh, I can have it all. And yet we confront the reality that we can't have it all at once. And that is sort of a, was that in the small type? What do you mean I can't have it all at once? I'm particularly for younger people. I'm strong, I'm energetic, I'm smart, I can multitask till the cows come home. What do you mean I can't have it all at once? And people get tired and burned out and, you know, disappointed and really sad because they can't do everything at once in order to make themselves, in no particular order, rich, smart, buff, popular, a loving partner, spouse, parent, Michelangelo, American Idol. What else shall we pull out of the drawer here?
You forgot, right? John Wayne.
John Wayne. There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, no,
so
it's true.
When we look at that whole laundry list of things of who we want to be in our private moments when we go to bed at night, turn off the lights and think, oh, gosh, I could do this, I could do this, I could do that, I could be, I could do. And so we confront the sort of the paradox, and I think we might have spoken about this on one of your shows earlier. Raise your hand if you believe that in order to be successful, you need to learn to say no. People will raise their hand and go, well, yeah, okay, keep your hand up. Now raise your hand if you believe that in order to be successful, you have to embrace carpe diem, seize the day. Well, yeah. Well, now I've got both hands up. And with both hands in the air, I really can't do much, can I?
And no, so and don't ask me a third question.
Hmm?
And then you can't ask me a third question because I'm in trouble. You just said it there. You can't handle it all.
That's right. That's right. And so we, first of all, have to confront that reality. Take a deep breath and say, okay, if that's true, and I've got both hands in the air, so I can't really do anything, so okay, I'll buy that that's true. What do I do? Because I want to do it all, and I want to have it all. And the answer is prioritize. And that's a very, very difficult thing, because in order to prioritize, we have to learn to say, it's not never, but it's not now, right? Which is a no. In the moment, that's no. If we cannot say no, we never really say yes. And this is a big, big, big truth, that when you sit with it and it sinks in, you start saying, wow, no wonder I'm yesing myself to death and really doing things that I'd rather not, because somebody suggested it would be a good thing to do, because everybody else is doing it, because I have to try out for American Idol. That's a silly example, but you know what I mean. Everybody's doing it, so in order to be somebody, I have to do it too, even if it doesn't fit my skills, even if it doesn't fit my interests, particularly, again, when we're in early stages of, you know, career and family. We got to do what everybody else is doing because we have to belong. And so it's very, very, very difficult to say no. But we have to, first of all, say, these things matter to me now. These become my priorities. Now I've got to focus on those two or three. We can't have six or eight or ten because we get distracted. And, you know, we just, it's like throwing ourselves out over the water like grains of sand. We just get scattered. And so one of the notions that I love to present to people to think about, right, we've got to have this intellectual framework if we're going to start saying, okay, I can set priorities and I can say no. Life is lived in chapters. And just because of the way we develop as human beings, those chapters require certain things. We need to learn how to, you know, understand what our bodies are doing and manage our emotions and go to school and, you know, get smarter in stages, et cetera, et cetera. And certain chapters define our priorities. And if we kind of separate those chapters into personal chapters, we look at things like, you know, our relationships, our families, our hobbies, and all of the me stuff. So that's one category that I might say I have certain priorities. For example, I really need to, as a single mom for me personally for years and years, one of my key priorities was my daughters. I took my job of raising them very, very seriously. So that was a key priority for a big chunk of my adult life. On the personal side, the professional side, I was also a traveling exec, so I had to manage that my particular job and that stage of my career when I was in that. That meant those two key priorities, you know, parenting my daughters and managing my traveling job, meant that I said a lot of no's. No, I'm not going to go out drinking with you guys after work. No, I can't play golf, you know, on a golf league. No, I can't be a volunteer parent at school. So in some cases, where we are in a particular stage in our life helps us to prioritize just because we have to. But today, many working parents are still wanting to be, you know, buff. They want to be at the gym a couple of hours every day. They want to run marathons. They want to be traveling internationally. They want to be coaching their kids' soccer team. So they're trying to do it all, without realizing that they're trying to live three or four chapters at the same time. It's just not possible.
No. It's like anything else. You take on too much, you dilute the effort itself. You focus, you stay on point, you got the full strength. But if you got three or four hands up in the air, what you end up with is dilution, and dilution brings you to disappointment, which causes a problem at home, at work, and every place else.
That's exactly right. And when we're in that state, what we don't recognize, and from my point of view, what we're not teaching very well or maybe at all, is that you can have it all over time. So if you have young children and you're working, maybe you can coach one of the teams if you can fit it in after work. If you can't, wait till they get a little bit older. Wait until you're more established in your career. Wait until you're in a different place with some of your other priorities. It doesn't have to go away forever. It just has to come later. And I see so many young professionals today wanting to be, you know, they want to be promoted quickly. Well, if you're on a fast track and you have mentors and sponsors within the organization or within your community or your business industry, you may very well be fast-tracked. However, that means that that particular focus has to be fairly singular. You're not going to want to be on Match.com. You're not want to, you know, trying to find your partner in life at the same time. And in many cases, that's exactly what's going on. I have to be successful in life. I have to be successful at work. I have to be awesome in my hobby. And we try to do it all at once. And to your point, that's where the dissatisfaction comes in. We get fatigued. We start asking ourselves, what's wrong with me? You know, that person over there is doing all of these things who may be 10 years older, unmarried, no kids. We look at it, we compare ourselves with other people who are successful and say, that's what I want to be because it looks good. But we don't necessarily know what those factors are for other people, and we diminish or discount our own.
And look at those very successful young kids that are actors, that are singers, that are the musicians, whatever the case may be, in and out of rehab. Lindsay Lohan, prime example. Yeah. It's a gorgeous kid, a talented, gorgeous kid. And I wouldn't want her life.
Well, right. Amy Winehouse gone at age 27.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the American Idol thing, I think we all will agree that helping young people, helping any person realize their potential, tap into it and develop it. Oh, my goodness, that's what we all want for ourselves and for each other. But on a, in a framework and on a time frame that makes sense. So the questions that we have to ask, obviously, the first one is, what do you want? And so make your laundry list, you know, again, in no particular order. I want to be rich. I want to be a loving parent. I want to be smart. I want to be fit. I want to be Michelangelo. I want to be John Wayne. You know, I want to be Christina Aguilera, whoever. Really? Is that what you want, or is that what you think others want for you? And at a very challenging age, of moving out, which used to be, what, 18 and now is 34. I was reading something the other day that I think it's in China. Kids are staying with their parents until they're 34 years old.
Unbelievable. Wait. Radio Sissy just got her face frozen up and she fell off her chair.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened?
You said kids are living with their parents till they're 35.
Yeah. She's like, oh, no, she can't stay that long.
That was it.
Well, the world has changed, and there are so many factors, you know, kind of influencing that particular dynamic that we could.
Do you want to know how the world
about.
Has changed? Would you really like to know how the world has changed? Ask me. Go ahead, ask me.
Michael Ray, how has the world changed?
50 years ago, if I would have had a cat urinating all over the place, I would have went to the vet and given him a shot, done something. The cat went to the vet today. You know what the cat came back with? Prozac.
What?
No, Wellbutrin.
same difference.
Yeah, okay.
So, is that okay. Right?
Yeah.
And?
So that's how the world has changed.
Yeah. Well, and yes.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that all feeds into this. I don't want to have to learn how to say no because I feel like I'm going to disappoint somebody or I'm going to miss out on something or they're not going to ask me again. Can't you just give me a pill?
Yeah, by the way, now I have a cat, and it started today right after he got his first pill. He's out under the tree going, hey, man, we're colors.
Well, so miracle market that miracle drug. Get your
Absolutely.
Cat on YouTube. Get your cat on YouTube. You know what? Your cat could do this, too. Call me. I'll show you how. And it's so funny because that's what's happening. And so we're creating a message that if you can't find a way to be precocious, to get on YouTube, to sell something, to make a gazillion dollars, you're somehow deficient.
Absolutely. I've got three dogs and four cats, and they're all on some kind of a pill as of this morning.
That's expensive.
That's four dogs and three cats. What are you going to do? One of them's on anti-depression. One of them is, they give them something for anxiety, and what is it when you leave, and
separation
anxiety.
Yeah. You need to call Caesar, the dog whisperer, and he's going to tell you?
What?
Run them. Get them out. Get them tired.
But that means I got to get up.
Yeah. That means, you know what? It's really not a priority right now. So give them a pill and shut up.
Well, you know what? To tell the truth, she brought male and dog Wellbutrin back.
Oh, my goodness. That is funny.
We're about out of time. And now we know the problems to everything is go to the vet. They'll give you pills.
Even at the vet, you have to say no thank you because, you know what, I've got a budget and, I'll take him for a walk. That's pretty funny. I'm going to give you a new website tonight because we are moving into a new body of work. And that is what the website is, www.backboneinstitute.com. And what your listeners will see when they go there is a registration form for Confidence Clinics. So we should probably talk about that at some length next week. But we are beginning the work of helping people work with the backbone elements, competence, confidence, and risk-taking. And our mission through the Backbone Institute is to create a stronger, more confident future, one person at a time.
I love every second of it. Susan Marshall, we're going to sit right here until you come back next week.
Well, take some nourishment.
Okay, I got Wellbutrin.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Good night.
Night.
If you love it lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, that's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Mayor Eisenstein with us. He's the author of Don't Vaccinate Before You Educate. He's the CEO of Home First Medical Pharmaceuticals. Mayor, welcome back.
Oh, welcome back, Michael. I'm glad to be back. It's my pleasure.
What are you doing? It's exciting.
I got some exciting news of a very recent study. It was from Professor Hector Paulone and his co-workers at the Vall d'Hebron Institute of Oncology in Barcelona, Spain. And he announced earlier this day that vitamin D, our friend vitamin D3, is very effective in the early treatment of colon cancer, has little effect late and after years and years of colon cancer, but also may be a preventative or lower your probability of developing colon cancer. And what his theory was that it takes up the receptors and stops the cancer cells from growing. And so in the early stages, it'll fill up receptors and slow the growth. Or in even before you develop colon cancer, it may be plugging up those receptors and not allowing any of the cancer cells to have a room to grow.
That's going to cost the pharmaceutical industry a lot of money.
Oh, my God, you're not kidding, you know, and that's one of the reasons why. And so his answer was you have to test for people because there's so much vitamin D deficiency in young people. Start with young people, you know. And so, you know, I wrote a piece where I'm offering the president some advice, you know, for this serious economic problems. You know, I didn't get a response. I did send it out to the White House by email, but I guarantee you I won't get a response because he's got too much time on his hands traveling around in a Canadian-made bus.
$1.3 million. Yeah, that you and I paid for.
That you, but it's a Canadian bus. Forget about it. We paid for it. That's a problem. But, you know, he wants to bring jobs back to America. I don't think so. You know, and so if every person in this country were given a free handout of vitamin D3, 5,000 a day, and I think you should take more, but 5,000 is a pretty good number, the cost would be about $50 to $60 million a year. The amount of savings and health care cost of people who have less, now we see colon cancer, breast cancer, less colds, less flu, the impact would be close to $1 trillion on the health care system. Have you ever seen something, Michael, that you get a 20-to-1 return on investment? You know, I mean, it's just, you know, so you want something to be done, here's something that should, you know, that should be done, you know. And I think most people would pay for it if it was endorsed. And in fact, if they talked about it like they did 2 years ago about the swine flu, I think the whole country in less than 1 year would become vitamin D sufficient.
Well, no question about it. And I think what the major problem that we have today basically is this: with healthcare, somebody goes to the doctor in general, and they're told that they have a symptom of whatever that is. So the doctor has to do now defensive medicine. So you got to take every test that you could possibly take. You get loaded up with all kinds of things that you may not need because the doctor is protecting himself. And it's not the doctor making money; it's the patients causing the doctor to protect themselves because of the lawsuits and the attorneys who sit in the middle.
Right. No, you're totally right. And I don't blame the doctors. I mean, look, I am a doctor, and I know that the stress that you have, you know, and even the tort reform they've talked about is blatantly absurd. What they need is no tort against doctors, you know, but have something very similar to they have in the vaccine program, where if you get injured by a vaccine, you can't sue the doctor, you can't sue the manufacturers. You go to a vaccine compensation board set up by the government, and they pay for your damages, which is kind of interesting, you know. And they've paid to date over $2 billion, which they claim is most probably just a handful of the real claims. But that's the way it should be handled. I think it's handled right. I think the whole vaccine issue is a problem itself. But I think the way it's handled is right, because otherwise you have exactly what you said, defensive medicine, where doctors are doing hundreds and hundreds of tests, MRIs, CAT scans, not because they think it's really necessary, but just in the remote possibility that something is there that they will miss, that they will be blamed for.
You know, you just made me think of something that I had not thought of before. What a natural thing for a government takeover of healthcare in the medical field. We have this reversible cause and effect that we just talked about. So it costs you an arm and a leg to go to the doctor's office. The government comes in and says, we're going to save money. It's going to cost you less. Why is it going to cost you less? Because you can't sue me as the government. And so they don't do all of the defensive medicine things, and it goes on from there. So I think there's some push behind this that we're not seeing.
Yeah, except you'll still be able to sue the government in Obamacare. I'm sorry, you can't sue the government. You'll be able to sue the doctor no matter what. See, that's where, because remember who funds the Democratic Party. It's the unions and the trial lawyers. You know, and so they're going to make sure that there's nothing, and the pharmaceutical industry. And so all three of those made sure that the Obamacare health plan would be come out smelling like a rose. And boy, let me tell you some of the planks in there. You can't buy pharmaceuticals from Mexico or Canada as an individual, even though the same pharmaceuticals that cost you one third or one fourth of what it is. Interesting, in Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, who may have his problems, but he passed something very neat. He allowed doctors to dispense pharmaceuticals from Canada, which were a fraction of the cost of the same pharmaceuticals that was here. And then Obamacare is going to override that.
No, by the way, Mayor, I've seen a couple of people, I know a couple of people personally, they go to the net and they go to the Canadian pharmaceuticals. The price is like, you know, it's slashed to maybe 10% of what they're going to charge here, and it's good solid stuff because they've checked them out to make sure it's not a scam.
That is exactly right, but the problem is they're not going to allow that anymore. It's going to be stopped. You won't be able to get it into the country. That's the problem that goes on. You know, it'll work for a while, but it's going to be stopped at the border. It won't be allowed in.
I'm going to have a problem with that. I just got into this in the last interview. My cat is on Wellbutrin now.
Yes.
I'm serious. Or something like that.
Why? Hey, put your cat on the radio with us. We'll cheer him up.
I know. Like it. No, he's doing his stuff all over the furniture. And they said it's a behavioral thing, so they don't want him upset, so they gave him a comparable to Wellbutrin. My cat.
Yeah.
And then I had to take a pill to be able to deal with it.
Now, let me tell you something. It's interesting, I mean, because veterinary pharmaceuticals also are the fraction of the price, even though they're exactly the same thing, you know, as the human pharmaceuticals. Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Your daughter is a vet, right?
I have two daughters who are veterinarians, you know. And they work together, and I'll have to ask them about that. That's very interesting, you know. You know, I'm sure. Look, let me tell you something. I like vets. You know, obviously, I'm very prejudiced. I got two daughters who are vets, but you know, they've got a very difficult job. They deal with patients who can't tell them what's wrong, so they have their diagnostic skills are incredibly good, and they really are. They're really very impressive.
No, I love it. I mean, you know, I've got a ton of animals over here, and there's a vet that I go to him, and he knows the dogs and cats, and he knows exactly what to do, and then we work it from there. But the point is that the government is going to stop it. Why will the government stop it? Because it affects the pharmaceutical industries that have to do with, you know, the multinational corporations and companies that are in control of all this kind of stuff that cause money to flow back and forth. That's it. They don't care about us. And I'm not trying to sound like, you know, advocating some kind of a conspiracy theory. We know it. And that's where the problem is. And nobody cares enough to do anything about it.
Well, it's the trouble is that the politicians only have one job, to get elected. I mean, that's their job, and after that they have no job. And so you kind of need someone who, we need term limits, I think. And my guess is there should be one term limit for anyone in office. That would eliminate the politics of is it the answer to everything? I'm not sure, but it's really a good start.
Sure. Well, you get people coming in, but I think there's a problem, and I'm not quite sure where it is because I haven't been able to put my finger on it in all these years, because administrations come and go, but inherently there are some of the same problems. You know, I'm not a great supporter of the president that we have today. I was a supporter of Bush. Bush had his problems, but the point of contention is the economic condition we have. Now, we got slammed, you know, in the last 2.5 years. There's no question. There was billions of dollars that went to places where it was a waste of money. Who was it? General Electric. One of their subsidiaries, which we gave hundreds of millions of dollars to, went upside down, and now they're in China. There was one of those, what was it? One of the wind farms, yeah, that we gave that kind of money to, major money. They went bankrupt recently, and they moved to China. So we have a very interesting situation, but where is it that we keep running into the same thing over and over? It may not be to the same degree, but it seems as constantly we're getting in trouble today.
Yeah, it's like nothing seems to change, you know, in the sense of And the question is, you're right, what is it that can truly make a change in the philosophy or the mentality of government? Well, you know, hopefully now we'll have some change to small government. And I think we saw the beginning of it in the 2010 election, you know.
Absolutely.
The midterm election. No question about it. And I love your governor in Wisconsin. My God, you know, I mean, this is a good man.
Oh, he's tough.
He stood tough to the unions. You know,
no, absolutely.
I think they tried to get rid of him,
and that didn't work.
Pardon? Yeah, that's right.
I mean, and, that didn't work. You know who I'm looking
for? They're going to win most probably a couple more of the elections that are coming up now to unseat the Democrats. You know, they lost the Republicans lost one seat in the. I've never heard of that before, of a recall election. That's like.
By the way, we've got somebody coming on the horizon. I like this guy, Rick Perry. He's tough. You don't mess with him.
I can't make up my mind, to tell you the honest truth. You know, I tell you why. He's got very strong ties to Merck, the big pharmaceutical company.
Sure.
You know, and he passed a law a few years ago, which he then had to retract from, mandating Gardasil vaccine, that's the sexually transmitted disease, herpes virus, to all 6-year-old and 7-year-old girls. And boy, let me tell you, that was very, very disturbing, you know. And you know, you say, well, it's only one issue, and but you know, I think he's more of the same with image.
You know what I'm looking for right now? Mayor, I am looking for a leader. I'm looking for someone, quote unquote, to follow. I'm looking for somebody to get in there and with no nonsense. Clean up what's there, get rid of what's there, come clean up our streets, you know, protect us from, quote-unquote, the gangs and the rest of it, and not to be giving billions and billions of dollars to all of these foreign aids that when we've got the same problem here at home, somebody who's going to come in and stop the division between black and white, stop the division between gay and straight, stop the division between, you know, I mean, we are so divided
right,
in this country right now.
I listen to him talk, and I tell you what I don't like, and maybe this is I'm old fashioned. There's a way of speaking not nice about someone, and I had that trouble too. And I didn't like what he said about Bernanke. It was absolutely true, but you don't make statements like we don't want to deal with those people in Texas.
You made both of us fall off the chair here.
Yeah. My wife says, "What are you talking about? You don't know how to mince words either." I mean, you know, but it's still there's. My grandmother said you have to have a certain aspect of respect. You can stick someone, but you have to be careful how you do it. I mean, he surely gets under the president's skin. I'll tell you that. And for that, I love it.
Yeah, for that I'm happy. Now, with the president, now I've got a lot of confidence in him. Now he's going to come back and he's going to tell everybody about the plans he's made, how we're going to get more jobs, the economy's good. By the way, if you saw him in the last day or so, he said we've got 20 million new jobs since he's become president and private sector and on and on and on. But he's not going to tell you until after he comes back from vacation.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. You know, unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable.
I know. But I think what's happened, and I'm really starting to watch it. First, I thought he was really smart, and his agenda was to undermine everything that we're doing. I'm getting a different opinion right now. I think the guy's over his head, and everything he's done was what he thought was right. It screwed us up really bad.
Well, I think it goes along with putting someone in who has no experience. Forget about anything else. He has no experience. You know, no teacher is ever worthwhile anything except to teach. But not, you know, well, we need a leader. I mean, and even then they may not be. In fact, when I went to law school, it's very interesting. I went to a night law school because I worked as a doctor still full time. And every professor there worked full time as a lawyer during the day and taught at night. And there's a whole difference between John Marshall Law School and many other law schools because these weren't theoretical lawyers. These were lawyers who told you what it's like in the real world. It was fabulous.
JT.
And he doesn't have that experience. End of story.
No. No, my contention is I don't care if the president. See, once the president becomes president, I've said this probably 1,000 times. I've never liked Hillary Clinton. But if she would have became president, she then would have become my president. At that moment when she becomes president, she's not a she anymore. She's not any particular religion anymore. She's the most powerful person in the entire world,
right.
And they have to transcend all these things. I'm looking for a leader. I don't care if he's black, green, orange, yellow, white, whatever. I don't care what religion they are. I don't care what gender they are. If they're the person that's going to get in there and do the job, I'm behind them 4,000%.
And I, let me tell you, so I agree with you totally, you know what I mean, and there's no question about it. You know, I agree. What more can I say except that, we should talk for about 20 seconds about the 11th Circuit Court overturning one part of the health care plan, the one that mandates insurance for everyone. And I thought that was kind of an important, that was important because that really... the importance of that was that the one of the two judges who voted in favor of overturning the health care plan, the provision that you have to be mandate, was a Clinton appointee. The first time a Democratic appointee has voted against the Obamacare.
And by the way, we're starting to see that. We're starting to see that over and over again with a tremendous amount of people within the party. He's not giving them what they thought they were going to get. You know, we can say all the terrible things in the world about anybody. When it really comes down to it, are you doing the job that you promised to do? And the answer to that right now is a resounding no. And it's coming from both sides now. It's just not coming from the right. It's also starting to sweep the left now.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And with that, Dr. Mayer. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. www.homefirst.com. And I'm also having a webinar this Sunday night if anyone's interested, you know, and it's going to be on how I lost more than 100 pounds. And I'm going to be talking about what is resting metabolic rate, and we'll talk about that in the near future. But that'll be Sunday night. And you can just sign up on the, it's complimentary, you can sign up on our website.
Wonderful. Hey, see you next week.
Oh, be well, my dear friend. Thank you.
Hey, take care. Good night.
Fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Boston.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Camilla Gray Nelson with us. She is the dog talk diva, specializing in dog training, especially for women. She grew up in a dairy farm in Petaluma, California. While other girls her age were playing with their friends and having tea parties with dolls, she was catching cows to ride, figuring out how to gather eggs without being pecked by the hens, and teaching her ponies tricks. In fact, most of her friends growing up had four legs, not two. And with her at the helm, that family farm has transformed into Derrydale Canine Center, Northern California's fastest-growing doggy dude ranch and training center. Services range from daycare and boarding to training classes and herding activities. And using her natural Derrydale method, she's trained her staff to have more. Well, actually, she's trained more than 9,000 dogs and owners from all over the United States. Camilla, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you, Michael Ray.
Thank you so much for being here. Okay, let's start out this way. I'm not a woman. I just thought I'd tell you that.
I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah, good. I have three dogs. Each one's about 100 pounds, and I've got four cats. And two of the dogs are just, I've had them since ever. And then my sister moved in with me, and then I got a hold of her dog a year before she got here. And he's lovingly known to you. Yeah, and he's lovingly known as the Beast. Shall I go further?
I think that says it all, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. By the way, the dog he's about 105 pounds. He's a blue heeler mix, and he's gorgeous, and he's wonderful. He's one of the most loving dogs you can ever get, but he's big time. He's got separation anxiety, big time. If anybody leaves the house, he's so aggressive that nobody's afraid of him. We just tell him to go away, but he is so aggressive that you would think he's going to bite you when you leave the house, and somebody comes anywhere near the place, you can't get him to stop barking. So other than that, no problems.
Other than that, perfect.
It's perfect. That's why he's called the Beast.
There you go. Who needs a security service? You've got the Beast.
Oh, tell me. You know, first
of all, we domesticated dogs. One of the reasons we domesticated them in the first place, it was before we had Brinks and before we had, you know, out here Bay Alarm, but I'm sure you have your version out there, so.
Yeah, it's called a 410.
Yes.
Yeah. But when you come down to it, and especially with women, now she handles him. There is no way that the dog's 105 pounds. If he decides to get a little bit, when I say aggressive, I don't mean, not biting, but aggressive, like he wants to move in a certain way, she can't handle him. So how do you deal with something like that? How do you get the dog? It's like when he's really barking, I'll say, come here, Jackie. And he'll come over and I'll say, sit. He'll sit down and he'll wag and he's got the biggest smile on his face. But when you go to brush him, like around his rear end, he starts growling and the teeth start showing.
Mm-hmm.
So I slap a muzzle on him and take care of the whole thing.
Would you add an element of complication with sheer size? I mean, granted you do. But here's the mistake most people make, women in particular, and I can say that because I am one. I had to clarify that too. They assume that if they get more serious in their voice tone, they get a little more assertive, they get more, if you want to say, manly, that their dog will then take them seriously. And my message is this: the true marker of power in the animal world is not aggression, it's not confrontation, it's not intimidation. It is quiet, effective follow-through. So when women come to me ill-equipped and unsuccessful in controlling their dogs at home, they are usually at the end of their rope. They are frustrated, and their voice and their demeanor show it. When I explain to them or show them, depending on whether we're doing a phone consult or an in-person, the secrets of quiet power, which, by the way, I learned from all the animals that I did grow up. Remember those early friends with four legs? They taught me the true meaning of power in the natural world. And I teach women how to maintain their center, maintain their emotions, and simply focus and follow through. Once you do that, sometimes you need a special equipment to help you leverage your power if you've got 150 pounds on the leash. But by and large, that's the message.
Yeah, but I've noticed that works, because if he's really aggressive at the window, his name is Jackie, and I'll just say very sweetly, come here, Jackie, come here, good boy. And he'll come running over, and he'll sit, and he'll smile at me, and the tail will wag, and we'll go from there. In his heart, he's a really great, good dog. Just that it's the aggressiveness and the barking that won't quit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And never say the word cookie around this house. They got to the point. Well, the other thing, too, is if I'm sure you've run into this. If somebody knocks, if I happen to knock on the wall, and he's all over the place because somebody's coming. And another very interesting thing, too, the dog's smart. When I leave, I will get my car keys and I'll throw them in my pocket, and he's doing his barking and the rest of it. He's got beyond that now. If I go to the store, I usually have a yellow sheet of paper that I'll write down what's there, and then I'll rip it off and I'll go. When that dog hears or sees the yellow sheet of paper, he's all over me.
Learn through patterns, and he's learned that that's the pattern. You know, first you do this, and then you rip the yellow piece of paper off, and then you're going. So you can break the pattern. The one thing that I hear in your conversation about Jackie is that he has too much freedom. He's got too much freedom to go where he wants and do what he wants. What usually happens is dogs start to calm down, and they realize they're not the king of the manor when you use some simple confinement strategies. Putting him in a lovely dog run that's plenty big for him and all the comforts of home, but not allowing him free roam of the house when you leave. When someone comes to the door, my favorite trick is I take the dog to a pillow or a bed about 10 feet away from the door. I tell them to stay there, but I also have a tether that's of my little backup power. It is for you to be taken seriously by your dog and for the dog to calm down because the organizational clarity has been made for him in terms of who's in charge of this family and what's my position, who makes the rules, and what rules do I follow. That has to do with limiting a dog's freedom, whether it's physical freedom or behavioral freedom. So in terms of your dog's situation, those are some things immediately that I would suggest if you were one of my clients. But that's the kind of thing that really has to be learned by people that own dogs. They don't seem to know it naturally. And I think it's because most people these days were not raised rurally with animals. Their only exposure to animals are either the pets that they treat as young children or substitutes, or on television where most of the footage about nature is there for entertainment, not necessarily for education. So this is a real important message for people not only with dogs to live more safely and effectively with them, but there are wonderful corollaries that transcend species, meaning once you learn how to calm down and control your dog and to quiet the chaos, it's amazing how you can use those same skills to control your children. You can use it in the workplace. It goes on and on.
No. By the way, I have two. My two are 10 and 12 years old, and they're both right around 100 pounds. One is a lab shepherd mix, and the other one is about 85% shepherd. They're both everything you could ever want in dogs. I mean, they're trained, they're good, they don't mess with you. Now, this is an interesting problem. I'm going to throw one out at you, and let's have some fun with this. And it's not fun, but let's have fun with it. Okay. I have my two cats, which I've had since they were 5 weeks old, and they're now going on 13. They were litter mates, always great. Never a problem around the house. The two dogs, two cats, everything's fine. So the other two cats get introduced to the house. It's one of those things where it just had to be where I had to get those two cats. One of the cats is fine. Now, the other one, as sweet as you'll ever get, everybody would want a cat like this, except for one thing. She hasn't been spayed yet. And now all of a sudden, I'm an idol here. She's after me. But she hasn't been, and she starts a wow, you know, the whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All that's fine, except, and one of the other cats like her, but that's about the extent of it. They're fixed. But the other cats, all of a sudden, the urine started all over the house.
Mm-hmm.
And she is whining, and they're doing it, and then the dogs smell that, and then they go and do it. And I'm sitting in a situation that I'm cleaning every day, right? But if you come in here, and if you're not used to it, you can't stay in the house more than 5 minutes. Now, this has been going on for about 6 months, and I'm lost, help.
So when is your vet appointment?
Oh, well, okay.
When's
let me tell
the vet
you
appointment to have her spayed? That would be the logical and the easiest and the quickest.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, yeah. And with that, the little one doesn't do it. She doesn't wet all over the place. But if there's furniture, she attacks. Okay, so she scratches it all up. So we get into a situation where my sister did take one of the cats to the vet. The vet said, now it's habit more than anything else. So that's what did right. she come back with? My cat is now on Wellbutrin.
Well, we'll have to talk about dogs because I'm not a cat expert.
I know, but it affects the dogs.
I wish I was for you, but...
Okay. All right. So anyways, what we'll do, effectively what we'll end up doing then is we'll talk about the dogs. But I thought I'd throw that out at you because everybody, it's one of those places where I guess it's a reversible cause and effect. Even no matter what happens with the cats, the dogs are going to do it too.
You have an interesting interplay of species, yes. But the vet is right. Sometimes things become habitual, even with dogs. What will start out as a logical cause and effect behavior will, if not addressed, develop into a habitual one. And I see this in dogs that experiment with aggressive behavior, and then it's not controlled or not controlled in the right way. And then even as the dog gets older, and then if it's a male dog, it's neutered. But the neutering doesn't help the problem because the problem has then become habitual. So living with dogs is a complicated thing, and yet there's some very simple principles. Understand what dogs are, how they're motivated. You know, dogs will only do what they enjoy. So if you're asking your dog to do something or stop doing something, the result of his compliance has to be worth repeating for the dog. People forget this. Many people, what's the biggest problem people have? Dogs don't come when they're called. Yeah. And I'll tell people, dogs aren't Marines. You know, they don't have a sense of duty. They have a sense of duty to themselves, and that is survival and pleasure and all of that sort of thing. So make the result of the dog coming to you pleasant. If you yell, scream, sound threatening, the dog saying, you know, I was considering coming to you, but now I don't think it sounds like it's going to turn out so good for me, which is why dogs don't come. Or they come eventually and the people are so upset that they didn't come fast enough that they withhold their affection, they withhold the treats, or worse, give them a scolding. So you can see how that cycle can disintegrate. Understanding dogs, understanding how they think, why they do what they do, the fact that dogs will only defer to a higher ranking member of their family pack. So a dog that's trained is one thing, but a dog that's obedient in the face of distractions, that's usually where people have the problem. And if they aren't seen by their dog as that leader figure, then there is no chance for obedience, because obedience isn't about what the dog knows. It's about who has the power.
They know you're here. They've all wandered down here.
All the dogs?
He's here and the rest of them, they all wandered down. What's going on? Okay. Now, you do phone consultations, right?
I do. On dogtalkdiva.com, people can set up phone consultation times for me. They can actually ask simple questions. And if it's a real simple question with a simple answer, I just write back. But if it sounds like it's going to be a little more complex and not so simple, we can set up a time and we have as long a phone consult as we need. It's very convenient for people.
Let me tell you what I think would be a great idea. I'm going to drive Radio Susie over here nuts, and my sister just walked down here. Think about this. Well, we do a weekly Let's Do Dog Tips every week.
Let's do what?
Dog Tips every week.
Dog Tips every week, yes.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Radio Susie will talk to you about that.
We can talk about that, yes.
That'd be a great idea.
Many dog tips will last us many years.
Many years, and I will promise one thing. Camilla will never mention the word cat again.
I have two cats, just so you know, and I don't pretend to understand them.
Do you bring them to another vet?
No, they go to the same vet that my own dogs go to.
Okay, all right, just checking it out. Okay, website we can find you at?
You can find me at dogtalkdiva.com. You can also find me through my Derrydale website, which is my boarding and training facility, and that is Derrydale.com.
Wonderful. Camilla, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to hear a lot from you. I think it'll be absolutely wonderful, and we'll never say CAT again. Okay. Hey, thank you for being
here. Thanks, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is.